From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, the world according to Lionel. Looking forward to that. Here's what's happening. So far, as many as six members of a terrorist cell involved in that Paris seams of attacks may still be at large, including a man who was seen driving a car registered to the widow of one of the gunmen. Two French police officials say that the authorities now are searching the Paris area for a Mini Cooper registered to the widow of one of these terrorists. The disclosures came as France has now deployed 10,000 troops to protect sensitive sites, including Jewish schools and neighborhoods, in the wake of the attacks last week that killed 17 people. The brothers, Sharif and Saeed Kochushi, as well as the other individual who was holed up in a Jewish delicatessen, their friend, they claim to have ties to Islamic extremists in the Middle East. They all died in clashes with police. Hackers claiming allegiance to the Islamic State took control of the social media accounts of the U.S. military's Central Command. Can you believe that? Posting threatening messages and propaganda videos along with some military documents. The command's Twitter and YouTube accounts were eventually taken offline, but not before a string of tweets and the release of military documents, some of which listed contact information for senior military personnel. A very strange story. Let's check in with Jerome Corsi on this one. Jerry, how did they hack into a military, you know, group of computers and grab documents?
It's pretty remarkable, isn't it, George?
Yeah.
You would think the military would have the tightest security control and it would be nearly impossible to hack into their sites. But I think this shows that hackers are really on a peer with government around the world, and you know it doesn't take a huge army to be able to shut down infrastructure. You wonder if hackers can get into the Twitter and YouTube accounts of Central Command. You know what? How safe our electric grid is? How safe any of the complex systems mm-hmm. we depend on for computers are when hacking is this able to be done?
And you would think North Korea would be sophisticated and they could do some of these things, but you would never think of militants, you know, running around in the Middle East have that capability, Jerry.
Well, but, you know, George, again, it's a matter of people who are sympathetic to whomever in the Middle East. I mean, the hackers could be anywhere.
Oh, that's a good point. They really
could be, you know, and they could also be anywhere and unknown. I mean, just, you know, people who are extremely good at the computer, have made this their devotion, are committed to ISIS, and could be located anywhere in the world.
All right, Jerry, thank
That's
you so
problem.
Much. Now, here's a story you're not going to hear on many media sources because, well, quite frankly, it happened in Africa, and they don't care because some of the people are poor there. Nigeria says the number of people who lost their lives in an assault by the Boko Haram militants on the town of Baga last week was no more than 150. As of today, they thought there were as many as 2,000 deaths there. The defense ministry said these figures included some terrorists who had attacked the town, and they faced resistance by the troops. There's a story there. Here's another strange one. The number of people killed after drinking a poisoned homemade beer in Mozambique has risen to 69 people. The beer, usually made from millet, may have been contaminated with crocodile bile. Divers have retrieved the crashed Air Asia's plane's second black box now from the bottom of the Java Sea, giving investigators the essential tools they need to start piecing together what possibly brought the plane down. The trapped cockpit voice recorder was freed from beneath the wing's heavy ruins early Tuesday at about a depth of 100 feet. A day after the aircraft's flight data recorder was recovered, it will be flown to the capital city of Jakarta to be downloaded and analyzed. So hopefully we'll be able to hear something and find out what's going on. Now, this records in a two-hour loop and all the discussions between the captain and co-pilot during their 42-minute journey should be available. It's probably a very frightening thing to hear. CNN is teaming up with the FAA for reporter drones. The cable network is upping its efforts to include unmanned aerial vehicles into its news gathering. They say a high fiber diet is linked to lower risk of death. People who eat the most fiber were less likely to die of any cause, according to a study. The finding might be explained by fiber's potential to lower the risk of chronic diseases, including heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and several types of cancer. A new study finds that people separated from their phones could suffer serious psychological effects. The study, done by researchers from the University of Missouri, found that users who were unable to answer their ringing phones while solving simple word puzzles, for example, increased their heart rates and their blood pressure. And there's another one. Men who regularly posted photos of themselves online scored higher on a measurement for narcissism and being psychopathic. According to Medical News Today, a study out of Ohio State University has found that men who took selfies were more likely to exhibit psychopathic traits when compared to control groups. Now, we're going to check in with our resident therapist herself, Catherine Switzer. Catherine, why, if a guy takes a selfie, is he considered a socio or a psychopath?
Well, that's actually the interesting point here, is that the study pointed to the fact that although of the 800 men between 18 and 40 that took this study, some of them showed traits that were exhibiting antisocial behavior, such as narcissism and psychopathic tendencies, it was actually very clear to state that they are not deemed psychopaths and narcissists. It actually begs the question as to why men are self-exhibiting such self-objectifying behaviors now, a behavior that we hadn't seen before in men. It was actually more something that women were exhibiting.
Everybody's doing it now. This study included 800 men between the ages of 18 and 40. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm beginning to see, too, you can see during social networks and stuff like that, you are seeing a lot of guys now taking these selfies of themselves.
Yes, that's what this is, a behavioral shift that we're seeing, that men have become so much more focused on their appearance and a superficial aspect of themselves that we hadn't seen before. And that's the sad trend that we're observing, and that was basically, I think, more the point of the article.
That's amazing. And if people need to get to your website, Catherine, where do they go?
SwitzerTalkTherapy.com.
S-W-I-T-Z-E-R, TalkTherapy.com. Catherine, thanks. She's a therapist in the Los Angeles area. One of my favorite actors of all time, Rod Taylor, is dead at the age of 84. He starred in The Birds. But the great movie, The Time Machine, it's that old one from the 60s, the adaptation of H.G. Wells' The Time Machine book. If you have never seen that, find it somewhere and just watch it one night. Up next, we talk about small miracles from beyond. Get ready for that on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. For the next couple hours, we're going to talk about small miracles from beyond. Yitta Halberstam has worked as a journalist, public affairs director, public relations director, and also director of special events. She's lectured around the world on topics related to the field of spirituality. And she and her co-author Judith Leventhal's book, Small Miracles from Beyond, Dreams, Visions, and Signs That Link Us to the Other Side, takes really a huge leap into the great beyond. And here is Yitta on Coast to Coast. Fascinating work, Yitta. This is one in a series, and they're bestsellers, all of them. Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much, and it's an enormous privilege to be on your show. Thank you for inviting me on.
Great subject. I just relish anything that talks about beyond. But you've taken it, and Judith has taken it a little step further, because you really look at not only the miracles from people who are alive, but things that are happening from people who aren't. I like, and this is book number 8?
This is book number 8. So it's very true that in the first 7 books, the mandate was to look at coincidences through a spiritual prism and to say that there is really no such thing as a coincidence. There's no such thing as a fluke or an accident or luck or fate or chance, but these are really spiritual events. People have to pay attention to them, be awake to them, follow their guidance. Sometimes they're little taps on the shoulder. Sometimes they're waves from heaven, but they're very meaningful events. And the first seven books really revolved around extraordinary coincidences that happen to people in their everyday lives. But as we started to gather the stories, we found that they started to fall into hierarchies. And people from all over the United States would write to us, and very often it would be the same exact story. It would, of course, have different names and facts, and the plot would be different, but the themes would be essentially the same. And one of the stories that we kept on constantly coming across over and over again was the story of deceased relatives appearing in the dreams of their loved ones to warn them of impending disasters or to give them good, sound advice. And we started to notice other stories that seemed to touch upon the mystical side of life. And we just decided, hey, let's go with it. You know, people today are really reading more of this literature. I think it definitely correlates to the temper of the times when things are difficult in heaven, in this sphere, on this earthly plane, as opposed to heavenly spheres. We tend to turn toward spiritual topics to kind of alleviate our distress and give us hope. And certainly, listening to the news that you just delivered a few minutes ago, I felt kind of like, wow, you know, coincidence is kind of a facetious topic compared to all the sobering events you just related. But actually, that is the true mandate of this eighth book, to bring solace and comfort and joy to people, accentuating the positive and telling them that not only is God with them in their everyday lives, but their deceased relatives are really with them in their everyday lives too. And we've gathered 50 stories from people all over the world that testify to this fact.
How did you find the people, Yitta?
Well, with the very first book, it was quite difficult. It was a challenge. We scoured newspapers and television and radio show transcripts and pestered all our friends and neighbors and relatives and went to the library. It was before the internet. The first book was published in 1997, and much to our tremendous shock, the First Small Miracles book was on all the bestseller charts. We were dumbfounded. After the first book, it sort of became self-perpetuating because so many people wrote to us or called us with their stories. We often did book tours, and we always opened up, we asked the audience members to contribute their own stories. So then it became much easier, and people really came to us with their stories.
Have you come up with your own conclusions, Yitta, on just what might be on the other side or what it is?
Well, you know, Joseph Campbell once said that life is not a riddle to be solved, but a mystery to be experienced. And there are definitely things that I find and many people find, or maybe most people find, I'm sure you find, that cannot be explained by sheer logic and reason. And they are tantalizing mysteries in our lives. Maya Angelou once said, a bird does not sing because it has an answer. It sings because it has a song. So even though we don't really feel, Judith and I, we're not philosophers, we're not psychologists, we're not scientists, we're not members of the clergy, we're simple storytellers, and we've collected people's stories, but we do feel that they're full of mystery. We feel they're full of hope, and we feel that they do point. You know, there's no evidence, there's no proof, but there's evidence. If you collect 500 people's stories and they all point to the same thing, you have to go with anecdotal evidence as being a certitude. Mm-hmm. And they all seem to point to the fact that there is a different dimension of which some of us are certainly not aware, but there is a different plane, and that when the person dies, the spiritual essence of the person departs the body and continues to live in some form. And the Zohar, which is the primary text of the Kabbalah, says that if it were not for the relatives of the deceased interceding on our behalf, this world couldn't exist for a minute.
Why did they intercede? Why did they do that?
Why did they do that? Because the eternal, the bonds that we form with our loved ones are eternal. They transcend time and space, defy death. They're watching over us. And so many of the stories that we've collected, especially those revolving around the Holocaust, mm-hmm. were mind-blowing in as much as people told us that their relatives, their deceased relatives, came to them in concentration camp, gave them precise instructions on how to escape the camp, and then told them where to go, and they were safe in the place that they were instructed to flee to. And, I mean, really mind-blowing story.
And it was all accurate, too, wasn't it?
It was accurate. Can I tell you one story?
Yeah, I'd love to hear it. Sure thing.
Okay, so I actually first heard this woman speak on NPR. She used to travel. You asked how I find stories. I was listening to NPR, and there she was. She used to travel the country speaking about the Holocaust to public school kids.
Mm-hmm.
And her story was really the story that I just told you, but in more detail. Her name was Esther Rabb. She's still alive today. She lives in New Jersey. And she was 15 years old. Her brother was 17 when they watched their parents murdered in front of them by Nazis. And that they were thrown onto a truck and deported to a labor camp. And the one light in her horrible darkness was her brother, Yidel. And somehow, miraculously, they managed to be transported and transferred from one labor camp to another.
Mm-hmm.
So Esther had her brother. He was her protector. He became her surrogate father, and she relied on him. And he got her through the darkness. And then one day in the women's barracks, she heard a cacophony of noise, a lot of shots and dogs barking and people screaming. And the next day she was told that men had tried to escape the labor camp, her brother among them, and they had all been killed.
Oh, God.
And she was totally devastated. She just didn't know how she could continue without her brother at her side. Then she was transported to the infamous Camp Sobibor. And as soon as she stepped inside that camp, incongruously, a flame of hope just rose up in her, and she had this strong intuition that she was going to be able to escape from this camp, which was really impregnable. And she ultimately, there are many stories about the famous revolt at Sobibor, and her name is mentioned prominently in all of them. She became part of the group that plotted to escape Sobibor. And the night before the revolt was to be staged, she fell asleep. And in the dream, her deceased mother came to her. And of course, dreams don't make sense, and the dialogues aren't linear. She said, "Mama, what are you doing here? Don't you know that I'm supposed to escape tomorrow?" And her mother said, "Yes, that is precisely why I've come down from the other world. I want to tell you that you will escape, and I want to show you where to go when you do." So in the dream, her mother takes her by her hand. They float out over the countryside. They land in a farmhouse. The mother takes her to a hayloft, points to the hayloft, and says, "There you'll go, and there you'll hide, and there you will be safe for the rest of the war."
Wow.
Then she wakes up, and she nudges her bunkmate, one of many, unfortunately, and says, You got to hear this. My mother came to me in a dream and said, And the woman rolls her eyes and says, "Bubba Mises, you know, superstitious garbage. Are you crazy? Dead people don't come to living ones in dreams. You're just nervous about tomorrow. The next day, they do have the revolt, this famous revolt. 800 attempt to escape. 500 are mowed down immediately by the bullets.
Yeah.
300 escape into the woods. One of them is Esther Rabb. They meet up with the partisans, but she tells them she can't accompany them. She's going to the place her mother showed her.
Hold that story right there. The place where her mother showed her. And welcome back to Coast with Yida Halberstam, and her co-author, of course, is Judith Leventhal, their work, Small Miracles from Beyond. So they're all running away. They're in the fields, and she says she's got to get back. Go ahead. Pick up that story from there, Yida.
Okay, I'm sorry. It's the longest story, but I apologize. But it's just so amazing.
Don't apologize. That's all right.
So, thank you. So she's running. She's walking through the forest for days. And the reason she's so certain that her mother really has come to tell her where to go is because in the dream, she recognized the farmhouse. It belonged to a Christian farmer who was a friend of her father's. And as children, she and her brother had played in the hayloft. So she knew exactly where it was. So she walked for days, and finally, after about 5 days, she reached a clearing, and she saw the farmhouse in her mother's dream. And she raced to the hayloft, and she just fell asleep. The next day she was starving. She realized she had to get something to eat. She walked outside. She knocked on a farmhouse, and a very kind Christian farmer gave her a jug of milk and a loaf of bread. Hmm. She went back to the hayloft. She started to eat, started to drink the milk, but the loaf of bread fell out of her hands. She couldn't find it. She scrabbled through the hayloft. She could not find it. So she descended the ladder to look on the floor underneath to see if it was there. And she made a ruckus. And the ruckus awakened the sleeping figure curled up in the corner of the barn. And the person jumped up and screamed, "Who's there?" And she thought, "Oh my God, now I'm dead. This is it. I'm finished. Probably a Nazi." And the figure again screamed, "Who's there?" And she couldn't believe it because the voice was unmistakably familiar. And she asked in disbelief, "Yedel?" The name of her brother. And he screamed, "Esther?" And they ran into each other's arms and kissed and hugged. And then she looked at him and said, "But you're supposed to be dead." He said, "No, I was the only one who escaped." She said, "But what brought you here?"
Oh, you're giving me chills.
I know, it's unbelievable. And I spoke to Esther Rapp to just make sure that all the details that she had recounted on NPR were correct, exactly as I'm telling it to you. And she said, "What made you come here?" He said, "Well, I remembered the farmer was very kind, and I came and I asked him if he would hide me. And he said, yes, but wait a second, what are you doing here? I was told that you had been killed in the labor camp. That's why I made the escape." She said, "No, it's not true." So he said, "But what brought you here?" She said, "Mama told me to come." And she recited the story about the dream. The next morning, Yedel approached the farmer and said, "My sister showed up and explained the circumstances of her appearance." And he said, "Can she stay here with me?" And the farmer looked at him and said, "If God brought you together in such a miraculous way, who am I to tear you apart?"
Oh.
And they stayed there for the duration
Priceless.
Of the war until they were liberated. And today there are only 30 survivors of the Sobibor revolt left to tell the story. But Esther Rapp is one of them. And it came through a miraculous dream. Now, how do you explain it?
You can't explain it. It's
no.
just, it's a miracle.
It's a miracle. I mean, I've read so many countless articles, George, where mathematicians and scientists try to explain coincidences away and try to say the mathematical probabilities or the scientific probabilities, but none of that explains a story like that.
How old would she be about now?
She's about 88 now.
88 now. Jeez. It's hard to believe it happened so long ago.
Yes. But a story like hers just inspires you with such tremendous faith. And and the belief that there's so much out in the world, both our physical world and our spiritual world, that we're really not aware of.
What do you think is that motivation, Yida, from the other side to step forward and to do what they do to protect the people that they care about?
Well, obviously, it's a tremendous love. And, of course, the next question that a lot of people ask me, and which I ask myself, too, is why do some relatives seem to be able to make it down and help their loved ones, and why doesn't it happen to everyone? So that's a very hard question. I'm bringing it up, and I'm really shooting myself in the foot because I don't know the answer. But the one thing I would venture to say is that sometimes these things do happen to people, and they're skeptical, and they discount it, and they dismiss it, and they're not attuned to it. So it may very well happen to them, and they have no idea at all. But why it happens to some and not to others, I'm not sure. My co-author, actually what really ignited the entire series was that she had this experience. She was dating someone, and she was dating him for 5 years, and she just didn't know what to do. He proposed to her, and she just couldn't decide whether to marry him or not. Meanwhile, her father had been deceased, and one night, apparently, her father, Judith's father, appeared in the dream of his friend, Herbert, and he said, "Herbie, my daughter is dating someone. Go tell her to marry him. It'll be great." And then he vanishes. So Herbie wakes up and shakes his wife, Ruth, awake, kind of like a scene straight out of Fiddler on the Roof, and says, "Oh, I just had this dream, and Judith's father appeared to me, and he said I should call her and tell her." And the wife is rolling her eyes and says, "Please, this is ridiculous. I mean, dead people don't come to living people in dreams. Forget about it." So the next week, Judith's father comes to Herbie's dream again and says, "How many times do I have to come from the other world to give you this message? Tell my daughter." And apparently, the way Judith recounts the story, split screen, apparently she had at that very moment of the day thrown herself across the bed, weeping and praying and saying, "Please, God, send me a sign. What should I do?" And just then the phone rang, and it was Herbie. And he said, "Judith, are you dating anyone?" And she's been happily married for 18 years, and all because of a dream.
Why does it seem that they have so much humor? Because they do, don't they?
They do. They absolutely do.
They're all like stand-up comedian ghosts or something.
You're right. I guess maybe when you have a much vaster perspective on the foibles of life from your new vantage point, it provides you with a good sense of humor.
And because your work, Yida, is about miracles, I'd say it's all pretty darn exciting and hopeful. But have you come across something where it was a little darker, but still a miracle?
That's an excellent question, George. You know, as a matter of fact, the first book, the first several books were published by Adams Media, and it was a small publishing company. We were their first bestseller, and the owner was Bob Adams, and he was intimately involved with the book. I mean, we feel so blessed because he really invested so much emotional and financial energy into the book. So apparently, when we first were told, you know, write a series of stories revolving around coincidence, we included some stories whose outcome was negative. They were like very weird and mystical and eerie and uncanny stories, but they didn't all end so well because we thought that's being realistic. And apparently the night before the book was supposed to go to the galleys, into the printers, Bob Adams went through the entire book, and he pulled out the stories that ended negatively. And the editor told me that he called her and he screamed and yelled and hollered at her.
Huh.
He told her, this is supposed to be a book of hope.
Inspiration, yeah.
Right, for people who are sick, ill, despairing, just lost their job, got divorced, have problems, whatever it is, this is a book of hope. So we're not being Pollyannish because we know that there are some strange coincidences that converge and create unhappy outcomes. But most of the stories that we have hunted down since that first book have really been very optimistic and shown us that there's a lot going on in this world that we are oblivious to and that we should be very grateful for, and gives us a sense of unity with all people and a feeling of connectedness with people and a feeling of awe and harmony and reverence for the world's mysteries and for God's hand in our life.
That's great. Now tell me about your other writing partner, Judith Loventhal.
So Judith is adorable. She's a comedian. She's like Lucy. I'm Ethel and she's Lucy. And she's
who's Ricky?
her husband.
All right.
And it's a wonderful partnership. We've become like sisters, and I'm very grateful to have her in her life. I met her through coincidence. She was dating me.
There are no coincidences.
No coincidences. God incidences.
That's right.
And she was dating my younger brother-in-law, and he brought her to my house, and I really liked her a lot, and we got along very well. And then they did not oblige me. I was hoping that they would marry each other, but they married wonderful people, but not each other.
Now, she's not from St. Louis, too, is she? Because I know a Judy Loventhal who used to live there. Okay.
No, but you never know.
You never know. You got to ask.
So then I didn't see her for a while. And then about 6 years after they broke up, we literally collided in an office building, and she wasn't supposed to be there. She was a social worker psychologist at the time, and somebody from her office asked her to deliver a package to someone in my office. And as soon as we literally collided, we said, let's do lunch! And we started to talk about coincidences. So I thought her idea of looking at coincidences through a spiritual prism, at that time, the first book was published in 1997, it was still very unique.
Mm-hmm.
Now there are a lot of books on the topic, but then it was very unique. And the minute she articulated her idea, my body went ping. And I said, I think that's a great idea because everyone's reading the Celestine Prophecy now, and it's all about how coincidences bring people to discover this treasure. So I called my agent, and she said, oh, that's a crazy idea. It's very kitschy. I had no idea what kitschy meant, but it sounded very ominous. So I first went to the dictionary to look up kitschy. But I continued to harass my agent because I just felt I was so sure this was a great, great idea to look at coincidences as spiritual events. And finally, my agent went to Newport, Rhode Island for Memorial Day weekend. And as she alights from her car, her next-door neighbor, who is an elderly, reputable, credible woman, approaches her and says, I have to tell you about this unbelievable coincidence that just happened to my niece. And the coincidence is too long for me to recount to you, but it's in the very first Small Miracles book. But it was such a crazy coincidence that when my agent heard it, she decided it's a sign. And she called us and said, okay, go ahead.
And there it is.
And there it is.
The fact that so many people have read your books, I mean, how many copies have you sold? Several million? Easy?
I'm still pinching myself, George, but the first seven books sold a combined 2 million copies.
That's amazing.
I'm so grateful.
Truly amazing.
I'm so grateful. I can't begin to tell you. Of course, my husband took our share and opened up a free soup kitchen for the poor. So I'm still living in a battered and bruised house, but I'm glad he did.
That's great. My first 2 million books sold 4 copies. So so you're doing well. What does this phrase, small miracles from beyond, tell you about what's happening?
Well, we feel that there are spiritual realms and that every now and then the veil gets lifted and we have an experience where we sense the transcendent. And we feel that if we are attuned to the messages, if we're awake to them, we can, you know, they're not only taps on the shoulder, little waves from heaven, but sometimes they're really directions or instructions. And I think it just gives us a sense that our souls are eternal. The book, I just want to clarify that the stories in the book do not only revolve around dreams from deceased relatives, but
some visitations, right?
There are some visitations. There are some reincarnation stories. There's a wonderful story about how Wayne Dyer found the long-lost grave of his father. Do we have 2 minutes?
We have exactly 2.5 minutes.
Okay, I'm going to try to make this really fast. So Wayne Dyer was, as many people know, Wayne Dyer really had a very underprivileged childhood.
He sure did. A kind of abusive, too, wasn't
very
he?
Very abusive, yeah. Horrible. And he was furious at his father. He spent a lot of time in an orphanage, a foster home, and he was furious at this father who had abandoned the family and then gone on to marry 5 other women. So he had this fury. He wanted to confront his father, never had a chance. When he had gotten his PhD and was teaching at Fordham University in New York City, a relative called him, a relative whom he didn't even know existed, and said, "I know that you've been wondering what happened to your father, and I want to tell you that your father died 10 years ago, and he's buried in a cemetery in Mississippi." And then Dr. Dyer thought, "Wow, he'd really like to go to the gravestone. He'd like to go to the grave and have some kind of closure. But how is he going to get to Mississippi? Because he was on an adjunct lecturer's salary, and he couldn't make it." And just then, somebody from his university said, "Would you go to the University of Mississippi for Women and make sure that the civil rights standards are being implemented, and we'll pay for the trip?" So he was thrilled because the university was located 400 miles from the city in Mississippi in which his father was buried. So last day of school, he goes to rent a car to take him to Biloxi, and the car rental place at the university tells him, "We have a brand new car for you, just came out of the factory." So he climbs into the car, and it has that new car smell, and he's looking for the seatbelt, and the seatbelt is encased in plastic, and he pulls it out, and in the plastic encasing the seatbelt is a business card, a white business card. And it says Candlelight Inn, Biloxi, Mississippi.
Huh.
And he thinks, "That's strange. How did the business card get into the plastic encasing the seatbelt?"
Of a new seatbelt.
Right, a new seatbelt, yeah. A new car, and it's precisely the city towards which I'm headed. So he tucks the card into his pocket and starts driving.
30 seconds.
Okay. When he gets there, he calls the cemetery, and the man says, "Yes, there is a Mr. Dyer here, but there's no way that you'll be able to find this place because it's a very remote, out-of-the-way place. The roads are very obscure. It's not a regular cemetery. It's for impoverished people, indigent people can't pay. It's on the grounds of a place called Candlelight Inn." And he flips over the Candlelight Inn business card that he found, and on the back is a map showing all the roads that lead to Candlelight Inn. He finds his father's grave, and he has the closure.
Amazing. We're coming back for phone calls and questions next.